Today, in part 6 of the series Building a Marriage, the topic is embracing femininity. Just what is a gendered heart? And what is the secret to a woman's inner beauty? How does one gain a gentle and quiet spirit? How do we understand submission? And what gets in the way of femininity? Here's Pastor Seth.
This week and next week, I'd like to talk about what the Bible says about gender. Today's topic is embracing femininity, and next week, what does it mean to be a man? I don't suppose there's anything more confusing in our culture right now than gender. Generally, on the college campuses, what our students are told are things like gender is really about your social or your sexual preference, or gender is really a social construct in which you were grown up and it was just sort of passed on to you, but you don't have to live by that social construct. And what our students are left with is something along the lines of whatever feels good, do it. The problem with that is that you miss out on who God made you to be. And part of that is the ability to come alive as a person and to be a blessing, whether you are a male or a female. We've had situations in the news where a man decides he wants to put on women's clothes and you know, does that make a man a woman? Well, obviously not. What if he goes through transgender surgery? Does that make a man a woman? Well, you could say he looks more like a woman does, at least physically, but or even sexually. But does that really make a man a woman? At the core of who he is still a man, whether it feels that way to him or not. What I'd like to do is take a look at some of the verses in the Bible that describe gender to try to come to a place of what does it really mean that what does it mean for a woman to be a woman? When is a woman really alive? What are the pieces of that that make that happen? The first part is the gendered heart. The gendered heart. In Genesis 1, right at the beginning of creating Adam and Eve, then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image to be like us." So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. And the thing I think about the most out of that made in the image of God is that we are made for deep relationship. More than just physical and more than just sexual beings, more than just emotional beings, more than volitional beings, more than rational beings. We are deeply made for relationship. And then he mentions a second thing that's a part of the creation of men and women. God created them, male and female, he created them. The male is the Hebrew word zakar, which we'll look at next week, and female is the Hebrew word nekeba. He created them. The Bible starts out with this premise, that there is not, it's not just that you're made in the image of God with the ability to relate well and deeply to people, but that but there are different genders that are uniquely different, and each adds something unique to the picture of relationships. There's something unique. Now, as we start, we look at the word nekeba here at the very beginning, the first chapter of Genesis, and the Hebrew word at its very core is the word opening. Opening. Now, immediately, probably like me, your minds go to a picture there. The word is also used in the Old Testament when the people are going to restore the temple after it had been in disarray. King Josiah goes to the high priest, and they decide that they're going to make the carpenters are going to make a wooden chest, and the carpenters put a hole in the top of that chest, an opening, so it's that the people, when they came by to give their donations, could place a donation inside of the chest for a noble and holy purpose. It's the exact same word used here as he says something about a woman. Now, as I ponder that, I think about, well, what does that mean? I think about, well, there's the obvious physical and sexual picture of a man and a woman coming together, and in one sense, that's productive. In terms of a child is given birth to or conceived and alive, comes alive and given birth to, productive. But it's also pleasurable in the sense that it's the sexual relationship is made to deepen the commitment of husband and wife to one another. There's something pleasurable and deepening in the relationship there. And then I think about, well, is our body design and function, is there something about a parable here of what the male soul is and the female soul is? Now, next week we'll talk about the male soul. But the female soul, what I think about is there something that's put into the soul of every woman, into the heart of every woman, that wants to warmly receive others into relationship? The deepest part about made in the image of God is relational. Something of receiving and warmly embracing others into relationship. It's just a beginning thought here. As I was writing this, I thought about a week ago, my soccer team, I have a girls, we just finished our season, girls U8, which is second graders, 10 girls, and we had our pizza party. And we were outside at a park and having fun and did the pizza and the awards and stuff like that. When we got done, one of the parents was talking to me, and they didn't know me that well before the beginning of the season, but they said, well, Seth, you've coached 10 years of baseball, 20 years of girls soccer. Which do you enjoy coaching the most? I said, that's easy for me. I said, girls soccer. And they said, why? I said, because when I'm coaching girls soccer, even second graders, there is something of a warmth and delight about them that is just infectious. It's sort of like life-giving. And also, it seems to me like I'm sort of invited into their world to participate in their world and to enjoy their world, like school and friends and a annoying little brother and an annoying older sister. All those things as a part of not just soccer, but a part of life. I say to the parents, I said, that's just entirely enjoyable to me. And you just don't get that same kind of thing when you're coaching boys baseball. Coaching boys baseball, you're going to get a lot of body sounds and a lot of grunting. And it's just a whole different world. There's something distinct and wonderful about the feminine soul that you can see even in second graders. Now, these girls, 5 of the 10 I had never met before the first day of practice. And yet they just sort of warmly took me in as a new assistant coach, and they just sort of rolled the relationship forward. All I had to do was just jump on the train. I like that. That's life-giving. As we think about this, a couple chapters later, we find a picture of what's the opposite of this. What does femininity look like when there's something that's gone awry? After the fall, God says to the woman, to Eve, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. All of you ladies know how difficult giving birth to a child is, but the picture here is something far deeper than just being at the hospital room. The image here is that near to the heart of a woman is her closest relationships. And not just in the child bearing, but the child rearing, she is going to find a much deeper pain that she experiences as a mother. And that's likely to happen all of your life. You see it when I remember as a young father, I remember seeing this. The kids learned pretty quickly that if they scraped a knee, they didn't come to dad. They went to mom. And there was a reason for that, because there was something warm and inviting that sort of enveloped the kids and enveloped their pain that was something that was harder for me to do as a man. The second thing he says, your desire shall be for your husband. You think, well, that sounds like a good thing. But the Hebrew word for desire here is not desire like you and I think of it, but it's a particular term. It means the desire to control. Your desire shall be for your husband, to get him to manage his life better, to make better decisions. Oftentimes, well, if I don't do that, he's going to mess up. Of course he is. And I say that as a husband and a father. Of course I'm going to mess up. The temptation is going to be to mother him or to manage his life in such a way that he doesn't mess up. And at one level, that seems eminently reasonable to every wife. But at the end of this verse, he gives a warning. He shall rule over you. The idea is it's not going to work. You're going to find what seems very reasonable to manage him and to get him to do what he ought to do in a timely manner. And he's going to resent that just as much as you resent his attempts to fix your problems. Same thing. This is when the beauty of femininity is smothered. It gets lost. That which was in the heart gets covered over by attempts to control my world. When I put these two words, these two verses together, I think of something along this line. Let's go to the relational femininity is a way of relating that both invites life-giving connection from another and nourishes life-giving relating in the other. This is the deepest part in the feminine soul that has been implanted in every one of you ladies. Whether you feel it or not, whether you're aware of it or not, whether it seems like that's a part of who I am or not, it's there as a reality. Now, on the inside of your handout, let's look at the second aspect of what does it mean to be a woman. And there's a particular kind of beauty that Peter describes in the New Testament of inner beauty. And our picture today depicts this, the attraction of inner beauty. First Peter says, don't be concerned about outward beauty, fancy hairstyles, expensive jewelry, beautiful clothes. Nothing wrong with those things, good things. You should clothe yourselves instead with the beauty that comes from within, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is so precious to God. You ladies hear that phrase there? Which is so precious to God. You hear something of your value there? Something that's already put in you that he enjoys? So precious to God. This is how the holy women of old made themselves beautiful. Now, in our particular culture, of course, the opposite message is what you see on every movie and in every TV show and every advertisement. Outward beauty is a thing that's extolled. And yet, Proverbs has a very important word to say about outward beauty. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is fleeting. Beauty is fleeting. I have a picture in my desk of our wedding picture. We were quite much younger back then in those days. And I can tell you that nobody from GQ is going to come and want to take my picture and put it on the front of GQ magazine. And even though, in my estimation, my wife is a beautiful woman, it's likely that Vogue isn't going to come and take her picture today, though they might have been tempted to 37 years ago. This is a true statement. Charm is deceitful, beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Fears the Lord is an important part of inner beauty. What does he mean there? Now, he's going to describe two things, a gentle spirit and a quiet spirit. What does he mean by a gentle spirit? What is beautiful about a gentle spirit? The Greek word is the word praus, and it was used in one sense to describe a wild stallion that's been corralled and tamed and now useful for wonderful purposes. Instead of just living for itself out on the range, now the horse brings joy and delight to the rancher or the people, the kids that ride the horse. A gentle spirit I think of is something along the lines of what you see at a football game on Friday night with the cheerleaders at a high school football game. The team can be losing 42-0. And this game seems like if you're on the zero line, end of this line, this game will never end. You look at your watch and we're still in the third quarter. And late in the game, the other team scores us 48-0. And most of our fans have left except for the parents. And most of the students have left. And you're just thinking, oh, can't they just call the mercy rule here? The other team scores a touchdown. It's now 48-0. And you know what the cheerleaders are going to do? They're going to get their pom-poms, you're going to stand up on those boxes, and they're going to incite the crowd who's left to go, block that kick, block that kick. Now, I've been there, I've watched that, and for the life of me, I remember thinking there's not that much difference between 48-0 and 49-0. But there is something of beauty going on there that's easy to miss. it seems to me more than just doing what they're supposed to do, their job as cheerleaders, is that the feminine heart intuitively sees a bunch of males out on the field that they know that are struggling, that are failing, that feel like they're just being publicly humiliated. And what they sense, what these girls sense, even at 15, 16, 17, is that somebody needs to believe in them. Somebody still believes in them in spite of their failure, their perceived failure. In other words, failure is not the ultimate message that we're going to give about you. It may be the message you give about you. It may be the message the coaches give about you. It may be the message your dad gives about you, but not me. That's a gentle spirit. And to a guy who's struggling, there's beauty there. The second is quiet spirit. And the idea here is not meaning quiet in terms of not saying anything. Again, it's a quiet spirit. Quiet spirit is something that's going on inside the heart. And the word means to be calm in a crisis. As it relates to marriage, my husband is not responding like to me or to the kids or whatever, to his responsibilities. But I'm anchored in something different than my husband. And therefore, I'm freed to relate to my husband, not to control him or manage him or get him to do what he ought to do, but to come alongside in such a way that I can see the struggles and see the burdens that he carries and somehow come alongside next to him as his partner, relationally. And what Peter says is, there's beauty. You do that. Beauty attracts. Now, the opposite of these two things is described in Proverbs 21, verse 9 and 19. Better to live on the corner of a housetop than with a house shared with a contentious woman. Contentious means quarrelsome, or I have to be right. There are times where I've talked to husbands, and they say, you know, even when my wife and I agree, it seems like we're arguing with each other. This is contentious. There's something going on in the heart of a woman that wants to make sure that what he's doing is right and what we're doing is right, and she's got to get that hammered down just right. One of the words for this is similar to a referee. Has his whistle. The referee's out there not to bless the people on the basketball court running up and down. He's ready there to point out fouls. He blows his whistle and there's a foul. Contentious wife is something like, well, yes, you did unload the dishwasher. That was good. But don't you know that you always unload the bottom rack first? Because when you unloaded the top rack, water spilled out from the tops of those glasses on the bottom rack, and now we have water spots. It can be something as simple as that. Does that really have to be said? Is that really important? The question asks is, at what cost? At what cost? Over time, a man just feels mothered. And what he learns to do as he's in home is to slowly do less and less. Because what he does always seems to have that little hand slap associated with it. He learns it's better not to say anything, because no matter what he says, it doesn't seem to be the right words or the right tone or the right timing. It's just better just to sort of pack it in as a guy and just sort of make do. That's the long-term effect when a woman closes her heart, is contentious and fretful. Fretful means never good enough. Now, in spite of this, the picture, one of the great pictures of femininity, is described with Jesus. And this is one of the great visions that I would like you ladies, I hope you pick up. In Matthew 11, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. What you offer to your husbands is the ability to warmly come alongside of him, invite him into relationship in such a way that he enjoys your company. There's something in your heart or spirit that comes out that just sort of allows him to, even with him being weary, meaning I'm just so tired of trying to do the right thing, I try to do the right thing at work, and it's never good enough for my boss. I try to do the right thing with my teenager. It's never good enough. And Jesus says, come to me. I know what it's like to be weary. Have a seat. Relax. I understand. And heavy burdens, he says. For guys, he says to us, I know what it's like to not win battles, that you keep losing. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to make decisions and you think you've got everything finally nailed down and chaos ensues after your decision. I know what that's like. I know the burdens that you carry that you can't solve the problems, some of the problems in your life like you'd like to. I know what that's like. Come to me and I understand. That's a picture or a vision of femininity, of what you ladies have the ability to offer to your husbands, that Peter says, that is beauty. There's inner beauty that attracts rather than repels. Now, the third thing I want to mention, let me try to get an understanding of what is a woman is as it relates to, and here particularly, to marriage, is understanding submission. Now, there are very few words in our English language that probably are more nails on a chalkboard than this word. This word is sort of like, it's right up there with the N word, it seems to me, in our culture. This may become the S word, or replace the other S word. And part of this, the understanding of this, is related to the idea itself, and some of this relates, I think, to men who have not understood this and related to their wives very poorly or harshly. Submission. Paul says in Ephesians 5:21, right before he begins his main dealings about marriage with this verse, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. The very next verse says, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. There have been plenty of times in my marriage where I submit to Mindy. That's pretty easy to do because there are a lot of times she's got a lot better ideas than I do. She understands the nature of people and kids much better than I do. I listen to her. I like her ideas. I say, hey, let's go with that. That's a smart thing to do. That's not a denigrating thing on me to submit to Mindy. That's wise. I'm the leader of our church, the senior pastor of our church. But if you ask Mark or Lance or Deborah, they'll tell you I regularly submit to all three of them in the decisions we make and as we dialogue about stuff. And I gladly do so because it's a wise thing to do. We have five elders, and we meet once a month usually and with Lance and I. And I think the guys would tell you that my attitude in those meetings is one of coming alongside of them as one of them, a sort of a mutual submission that we, as we relate to one another. And that's a good thing. In the abundance of counselors is wisdom. That's not a bad thing. It's not a denigrating thing to me to submit to the elders. It's a matter of wisdom. If you think about what Christ did, Philippians 2, 5 through 11 talks about how Christ submitted himself to God's purposes, even coming as a human being, even coming as a servant, and even giving himself up in death. That doesn't denigrate him. At the end of that passage, the Father in Philippians 2, 5 through 11 says, I'm going to raise him up to the highest glory. There's something wondrous that goes on, what went on with what he did. Submission has a dirty sort of connotation in our culture. But when it comes to how you and I live, submission is a positive quality. Now, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. We're going to talk about this next week. A husband has to submit to his wife and to God's purposes. How? As a servant leader. Now, normally when you hear leadership in the family, what people hear is the leader part, and they hear the perks of leadership and the advantages of leadership. What they don't hear is the servant part of leadership, the responsibilities of leadership, the cost of leadership, or the sacrifice of leadership. We'll talk about this in detail next week. In Genesis 2:20, the man gave names to all the livestock, the birds of the heavens, to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper. Hebrew word is ezer. Fit, meaning corresponding to. We looked at both of these in detail last week. If you missed last week's message, go online and if you'd like more information about these two important words. A corresponding fit alongside of him, for him. Ezer means strong helper. A strong helper. Now, this past year, in the fall, I hoped to coach 10 girls that I've coached before in North Irvine. I hope to coach in South Irvine. And through some dropping of the balls, that didn't happen. And I ended up, instead of coaching 10 girls, I ended up not even being a head coach. And God sort of rearranged things, and I got to team up with one of the coaches who had four of the girls I coached, and we were able to get a fifth girl on that team. And so instead of being the head coach of 10, I was the assistant coach of at least five girls I've coached before, plus a new five. Now, my head coach had coached 1 year. He's a delightful man. He's a smart fella. He's a professor over at UCI. He's got his PhD. He's about 10 years younger than me. He loves his daughter. He's fallen in love with soccer, and he's doing the best he can to learn about the game, and he prepares for practices and prepares for games, but he does so like a guy who's been at this about a year. Now, I went up and asked him at the beginning of the year when he heard my story, could I be your assistant coach? He said, yes. Now, I've coached 20 years. That's a lot of experience. To this man's credit, he allowed me to come alongside of him as an assistant coach, and he utilized about every strength I have. Before the game, I know how to get the girls prepared for a game and at this level, what they need before the game, not just physically, but mentally, in terms of where do I go and position, stuff like that. He let me do all that. Loved it. He asked me my opinion on the positions the girls should play, and we emailed back and forth about that. And he got to make the final decision on that. But most of the time, he went along with my assessment of the girls and where they would do well. During the game, he let me coach on the sideline as if I was the head coach. And at the end of the game, after we'd done all the high fives and handshakes and all that stuff, he let me do our post-game thing, which is where my gifts and talents probably shine the most in that environment. I was an assistant coach, and I had the luxury of not having the responsibility and the headaches of being the head coach and having to make personnel decisions and deal with parents, but at the same time got to use my strengths alongside of him to help our team be successful and to help him be successful. Now, what the Bible pictures here when it describes submission is that you ladies are much better at that than even I was with my head coach. There's something within you, your relational abilities, we call it women's intuition, where you understand the nature of human beings and sort of the nature of relationships and emotions way better than us lugheads. And that may and that makes the whole, when you catch that and appreciate that, that makes the whole enterprise much, much better. 1 Peter 3, this is how the holy women who hoped in God, and there's an important phrase, not hope in their husbands, do not hope in their kids, do not hope in validation is going to come from a guy who gets it. I'm going to bring him here next week so he gets it. Who hoped in God for their validation and value, used to adorn themselves by submitting to their husband. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Now, again, that probably just sends shivers up the spines of people in our culture. Sarah responded to Abraham, as we'll see in a moment, calling him Lord, and we'll look at what that means in a moment. The scriptures just tell of one time she did that, and she did it while she was talking to herself, while she was mulling over something. You are children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. In a minute, we're going to look at the last part of this. What keeps a woman from living out this inner beauty, and as he says here, fear. What is he describing? What did Sarah do? Well, if you go back to Genesis 18, Abraham had been told when he was about 75 years old that he's going to have a son, and through that son is going to be a nation and millions of people like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, and that there's going to be a coming Messiah through that line, and he was pretty excited about that. But 80 went by, and no kid, 85, 90, 95, he's 99 years old, still no kid. And he's got some questions about this. Sarah is now 89 years old. She's got some questions about this. And there comes a time in Genesis 18 where some messengers come to visit, and Sarah's in the tent, just inside the tent where she hears Abraham talking, and the Lord is one of the messengers. And the Lord reminds Abraham that you're going to have a son. And inside the tent, the scripture says that Sarah laughed to herself. And there's something of the laughter of scorn, which says, yeah, right, at this age and with that guy. And there's sort of it's sort of implied, I think, that it had been a while since they'd been physically, sexually intimate together. And so the question of sort of, yeah, right, was not just a question of age, but something else in addition to that. And yet Abraham heard the word from the Lord, and I think even though it had been quite a while for both of them, the scripture indicates that he moved towards her, and she responded. Even though it seemed to her like, what's the use? Nothing's going to happen. And yet she responded to him. Sure enough, a few months later, she discovered she was pregnant. And they had their long hoped-for son, Isaac. The picture here of submission is a willing response. And it's not just sexually, but a willing response to a husband when he initiates relating. Warm response to masculine relating. Now, let's finish up. What gets in the way of femininity? And it's fear. As Peter describes there in 1 Peter 3. You might be sitting here listening and you might think, you know, Seth, the world you're talking about is not my world. I look in the mirror and I see a woman that has a not good chin. I see a nose that's not beautiful. I try to do something with my hair, and I have a hard time with that. But even more than that, the idea of inner beauty, it seems to me like I've tried to be that person, and it seems like nobody really responds. And I've kind of given up the idea that there really is anything beautiful inside of me. A lot of women feel that way. I think what God would say to you, that's a lie. That's a lie. I have put an inner beauty in you when you were conceived. And there may have been plenty of people in your life who have never enjoyed that beauty or delighted in that beauty or seen that beauty, or people who have engaged with you as you would like them to relationally. But it's there. And instead of giving in to fear, which of course men have their version of fear, we'll talk about next week. But instead of being afraid of that and closing your heart off to protect yourself or to try to control yourself from pain or to try to position yourself in order to get something from your guy, what's it like to be open to welcome? The hope being that I see your beauty. Your husband may not, but I do. And when I see you exhibiting that kind of openness, I'm in heaven going, that's my girl. That's a daughter of Eve. That's how it's supposed to be. That's how Jesus relates. I want people to pick up through your responses how my son invitationally invites people who are weary and carry heavy burdens to come and to be a part. You might say, but if I'm that way, What I've learned in life is that my father didn't sit down and explore my inner world with me. My husband doesn't sit down and after the end of the day and try to discover what was going on in my day-to-day and how I felt like that. Even godly men I know hardly would know even to celebrate something inside of me. Is that even a category to us lughead guys? And so the most rational thing to do is to fear. If your value is related to how a guy thinks of you, then that makes sense to you. And you'll close off that part of your heart, the gentle and quiet spirit that is gendered femininity, and you'll push that thing way, way deep. And instead, what you'll work at, you'll find yourself doing, is managing your world by doing. And you'll load up your day with lots of things to do, a lot of good things to do. And you will find yourself restless, with little rest, little joy, and mostly pressure. What if I invite and no one comes? What if I'm opened and I remain unentered relationally? What if I try to nourish, my husband goes elsewhere? I want to be seen. I want to be taken into account. I want to be engaged. When I ask my husband, husbands, when your wife asks you, how is your day? That is not a question for information. That's an invitation. She hopes you'll pick up on the cue because she doesn't want to have to say to us lugheads, I would really like for us to sit down and have a conversation, but I don't want to have to be the one to ask you or to sort of force you to do something you don't want to do. What I hope is that you will pick up my invitation and respond. That you will see something delightful in me, even when we're talking about the simplest things of the day. That you will enjoy my presence and you will find pleasure in something of who I am. We'll talk about this more, guys, next week. Marilyn Monroe was sort of the sex goddess of my day growing up. And all of us young guys, you know, dreamed about Marilyn Monroe. But the biography of Marilyn Monroe is a rather sad story. You might think at one level that, well, she had all the outward sexual, physical beauty that anybody could want, and guys wanted to be with her. But that did nothing for her inner world. And later on in life, before she took her life, she bought a black wig. And she would go to different bars and clubs, not as Marilyn Monroe, but just as a woman with a black wig and in disguise, with the hopes that somebody would see the beauty inside of her and want to relate on a basis other than outward beauty. An invitation that she hoped would be received. Let's finish with this. As I think about this, let's go ahead and move on. Keep on going. Go to the last slide, if you would, Lisa. When we know Jesus enough to value nothing greater than to enjoy him and reveal him to people, meaning lughead husbands, by the way we relate, we will become more alive. And we'll talk about this next week, as masculine men and feminine women. Let's pray together. Father, as much as I've tried to put into words what the Bible says about femininity, I am a masculine man, and there's a part of me that will never completely understand the world with which our ladies live. The heartaches and the pains, the temptations to fear, the temptations to hide, to control. But I do pray that you would give our ladies a vision of the invitational love of Jesus Christ that he offers. Come to me, all you who are weary, who are tired of fighting battles, who are tired of trying to do the right thing, who live with the weariness of pain that doesn't seem to subside. I know what that's like, Jesus said. I've experienced that. Come to me. And you who are heavy burdened, who fight battles that can't seem to win, at least not very often, who carry heavy burdens for your son, or heavy burden for your daughter, or heavy burden for your work, or do I have what it takes as a man to really do well in this life? It doesn't seem like in so many areas I just don't do well. Jesus has come to me. He said, this is a place where you'll find rest. This is the place where you can sit down and relax. And in spite of the battles you lose, you're valuable to me. Your life matters to me. Father, would you give our ladies a vision of what you desire for them to relate, to reflect something of the glory of Jesus Christ in a sometimes painful world.